The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful day here at Edstone after quite a few days of rainy, cold, windy weather. So it's nice to see the sun out again, and the birds are chirping away out at the bird feeder. We still need to get some footage of that, Sam, so we'll have to schedule that here in the next, probably in the spring months. When it gets warmer, we'll see all kinds of varieties of birds, I'm sure. Coming up on today's program, Victor Davis Hanson had a wonderful tribute to Rush Limbaugh. Of course, he's still around. It's not like he's died. But he did come out with the announcement a week or two ago about having lung cancer. But we'll go through, in the second segment, we'll go through bits and pieces of Mr. Hanson's tribute to Mr. Limbaugh and his impact on talk radio. That got our attention for obvious reasons. But another reason it captured my attention is that every time I hear about how much of an impact he had on talk radio, and he certainly did, it makes me think of the impact that Herbert Armstrong had on radio and broadcasting back in the 1930s, and the way that God's message just went right around the world with those daily radio broadcasts. It started out, I know, every week, but the work certainly did grow large because of Mr. Armstrong's daily broadcasting. And that's really what we had in mind when we started KPCG almost 5 years ago. Hard to believe we're coming up on the five-year anniversary in May. Well, last night they had the New Hampshire primary. Went just a little bit smoother than Iowa. They were able to get the results the same day. President Trump pulled in quite a showing once again, even though he's really in an uncontested race. I forget the figure, but I saw a tweet last night saying that he pulled in more votes than incumbents going back even decades. But of course, the big news was on the other side, the Democrat side, where Bernie Sanders eked out a victory against Pete Buttigieg, who barely won in Iowa. So Sanders' victory follows a pretty strong showing in Iowa just last week. But Bernie Sanders, think of it, he's the Democrat frontrunner so far for 2020. We're only two states in, and I know, like Joe Biden said, it's only just starting. He got out of New Hampshire pretty quick last night, by the way, as he made his way down to South Carolina, I think it was. So a lot of commentators were saying he pretty much threw in the towel knowing he wasn't going to get a strong finish. What did he get, fifth, I think, in New Hampshire? So pretty poor showing, 9% of the vote for the former vice president. I saw another article last night saying that in the three times that he's run for president, I don't think he's picked up a delegate in New Hampshire. So you can see why he got out of there quickly. But coming back to Bernie Sanders, just think about this. He hasn't won the nomination yet, but this is the front runner for the Democrats. And for 3 years, the Democrats have been telling us that Donald Trump was a Russian agent, that Russians influenced his victory in 2016, that Russians were even blackmailing the Trump presidency. And all of these, of course, have been proven to be demonstrable lies. And now these same people, think about this, these same people put forward an actual communist to run against Donald Trump. You cannot make this up. And they do it with a straight face. After insisting wrongly that Trump was a Russian agent, here they are. Here they are about to anoint a Russian agent to run against Donald Trump. On February 2nd, we played this last week, when asked about Bernie Sanders, Here's what the president had to say, clip four.
Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think he's a communist. I mean, you know, look, I think of communism when I think of Bernie. Now, you could say socialist, but didn't he get married in Moscow? What? At least he's true to what he believes. That's one thing.
It used to be that he was proud to be labeled a communist. Now, he doesn't say that now. He's trying to get voted in as president. But back in the day, the president is right there. He honeymooned in Moscow. He's been a proud communist. Now he calls himself a democratic socialist. This is who he is, though. And President Trump says at least he's somewhat honest about it. But the thing is, a lot of people, a lot of young people in the United States, this is what they want. They want communist ideology. They want the so-called Democrat socialist. Because the communist infiltration into the United States, it runs so deep now that here he is as one, potentially, as one representing the two big parties. You'd have Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders if he were to win the nomination. PJ Media had a great piece just today. Or maybe it was yesterday before the results came in. In any event, it says, when the Soviet Union finally collapsed in 1991, Americans thought the Cold War was finally over. The epic struggle between totalitarian state control of the economy and democratic capitalism had been resolved decisively in favor of the latter. And so we supposedly won the Cold War. But it says here, fast forward a generation, and a self-described democratic socialist who honeymooned in the USSR and supported political platforms copied from Soviet-aligned dictators is the odds-on favorite to win the presidential nomination of one of America's two major political parties. Marxist ethnic studies programs are headed for California schools, and the democratic socialists of America are infiltrating schools elsewhere. Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto receives a shout-out at the Oscars. Workers of the world unite. And then this author says here, what is this, 1917? Are we in 1917 again? You have these two filmmakers just the other day quoting from Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Here's what they said. This is clip one.
Working people have it harder and harder these days, and we believe that things will get better when workers of the world unite.
I think her name's Julia Reichert, but anyway, she co-directed this documentary winner called American Factory, and this is produced, by the way, by the former president, Barack Obama's new film company. And Barack Obama was quick to tweet out, congratulations. His film company produces this video or this movie. And then she gets up and says, workers of the world unite, which is how the Communist Manifesto ends. Workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. That's Karl Marx. That's communist ideology. It's right there on stage with all these radical left-wing activists. It says in this PJ Media article, America emerged victorious in the half-a-decade Cold War struggle, but it may have experienced a far more consequential defeat, a loss of internal confidence and inspiration. It says, while the USSR has been consigned to the dustbin of history, and good riddance, its ideological program has thoroughly infected the USA. So the USSR is gone, but the communist ideology is not. It is alive and well right here in the United States. Now, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, he was right. Herbert W. Armstrong was right. And I keep referring to this recent article by my father in the March issue of the Trumpet magazine. America has been fundamentally transformed. He talks in that piece about how that after World War II, when the attention shifted away from the threat of Nazism, that most people focused in on communism, and rightfully so. It was, you know, there was a Cold War that went on for 40 or 50 years. And of course, during that time, Mr. Armstrong was saying Germany is going to rise again. Germany is going to lead 10 nations out of the heart of Europe. Germany is going to lead the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. He said the United States and the Soviet Union, they're not going to have a hot war. A cold war, okay, but they're not going to go to war with one another. But that said, Mr. Armstrong did. He very much did recognize the threat of communist ideology, and he wrote a lot about that. And my father quotes and paraphrases that in this March 2020 trumpet piece. Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1956, he talked about this new war that Russian communism was waging against the United States. He said it was a psychological warfare of propaganda, infiltration, subversion, demoralization. It's a warfare that has attacked our minds, our moral and spiritual values, rather than our bodies and our earthly possessions. That's Mr. Armstrong writing in 1956. This propaganda, this psychological warfare, this infiltration, this subversion. And now listen to what PJ Media says. The Soviets tried to plant communists in many U.S. institutions, and the far left drift of Hollywood and academia may trace back to their efforts. Influential academics like Howard Zinn have redefined American history, demonizing the founders by focusing on the evils of slavery and neglecting the unique historic achievements of Western and American civilization. Freedom, science, free markets, and a degree of prosperity unknown in the history of the world. All of that's bad. And really, that's a lot of what Donald Trump campaigned on in 2016. Freedom, free markets, prosperity, the economy, reducing regulations, lowering taxes, so that Americans were free to do what Americans have done fairly well the last couple hundred years. Of course, God has had a hand in it all. We know this because of the blessings he promised to Abraham, the descendants of Abraham. But still, what a clash of ideologies. And by the way, I think it's the same issue of the trumpet, Joel Hilliker's piece. It follows right after my father's on, I forget the title, but it's about what they're teaching your young people, your children, in school, in American schools today. He mentions Howard Zinn, in that Howard Zinn's, you know, the people's history of the United States, and then he's got the young children's version even, as they try to indoctrinate American youths with this message. And when you see Bernie Sanders leading the way, there it is on the screen, what is your child learning in public school? It's an excellent article. The whole issue, the March issue, hopefully you're going through that. But what is your child learning in public school? What's he learning in the university? What's he learning on the college campus? He's learning a lot about democratic socialism. That's what he's learning. And you can see the fruit to come from that by these primaries. Bernie Sanders is out front? The communist? Really? That's how deep-seated this infiltration really and truly is. It says I read that quote, but it says further on, while Adolf Hitler directly killed, well, he goes on in this PJ Media article and talks about, and compares free markets and the freedom of American society. He compares that with the totalitarian states of the 20th century. It says, while Adolf Hitler directly killed 12 million in the Holocaust, Joseph Stalin killed between 18 and 45 million when his plans to remake the Soviet economy led to devastating famines. China's Mao Zedong. This is the one that a lot of people in public schooling have never heard of. Mao Zedong was responsible for an estimated 50 to 80 million deaths. This is just in the 20th century. 50 to 80 million deaths, partly through the deadliest famine in history. Stalin and Mao caused the deaths of millions in the name of helping the lower class and upending the oppressors. We've got to upend the oppressors and convince the workers of the world to unite. And people heard it on national TV the other night with the award show. It's all about helping out the lower class, the working class, the workers of the world, so they say. Even as tens of millions have been slaughtered by this ideology or starved to death. And it's happened over and over again in nation after nation after nation. And yet you have proud communists today, like Bernie Sanders. This PJ Media article says that he was out there supporting the Soviet-style policies for America during the Cold War. Forget about this campaign season. Even as America was at war, it was a Cold War, but even during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, he was saying, hey, we need this communist ideology. We need a communist government. I don't mind if you call me a communist. I like to honeymoon in Moscow. The article says that he endorsed the Socialist Workers' Party in the 1980s. That's Bernie Sanders. He's now the front runner. You can see why so many even left-wing Democrats are spooked by him. You could see why they tried to undermine his campaign a few years ago. And why they might do it again. Here's what Chris Matthews said the other night on MSNBC, clip two.
The issue of this campaign, it is that word socialism. Some people like it. Younger people like it. Those of us like me who grew up in the Cold War and saw some aspects of it after visiting places like Vietnam, like I have, and seeing countries like Cuba being there. I've seen what socialism is like. I don't like it. Okay? It's not only not free, it doesn't work.
It's not free. It doesn't work. He doesn't like it. That's Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews is saying that. He's old enough. He's traveled enough to know that it's failed over and again. It doesn't work, he said. Here's another Democrat, Representative Tim Ryan. I think he's a Biden supporter, so he's a little bit biased in the direction of Biden, I suppose, but listen to what his analysis is on Bernie Sanders. If Bernie Sanders were to win the nomination, clip three.
I personally am very, very concerned about some of the folks who are running. I think, you know, if we run under a democratic socialist banner in 50 states, I think we lose the industrial Midwest. I think we lose 48 states. I think we lose working class union voters who have negotiated their private health care and want to keep it. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to be forced into a public health care system. You lose those voters. And I think some of the other issues as well. I think that would be disastrous for us.
That's a Democrat saying it would be disastrous if he gets the nomination, that we could lose 48 states, that this could be a landslide in the favor of Donald Trump. You do have to wonder, by the way, what Mr. Trump is thinking, who he's hoping for as far as an opponent goes. And all of the old video and statements and pictures that are sure to resurface if he goes forward and wins the nomination. Let's look at his history. Let's look at his associations. And maybe this time around, more people would pay attention than they did in 2008. When another progressive socialist with all of these disturbing connections to Reverend Wright and Bill Ayers and all of these radicals, and most just covered that up, certainly all of them in the Democrat media complex, they covered it up. Now, they're probably going to be working to expose it. with respect to Bernie Sanders because they don't want him to go against Donald Trump. They know that the chances would be slim for him to come out victorious. Now, obviously, Bernie's not out there saying, hey, I want to be just like Stalin and Mao. I want to see tens of million people starve to death. No, but what he's out there saying is, essentially, I want the government to control practically everything. I want the size of government. It's already massive, but I'd love to see it expand further. I'd love to see it double and triple in size. And we've got to take in all of these taxes and redistribute the wealth. We've got to go after big business. We've got to go after Wall Street. We've got to have all of these social programs. We've got to have free service when it comes to health, when it comes to college, universities. It says at PJ Media, if Bernie Sanders were to win the Democratic primary, defeat Donald Trump in November, and somehow cajole Congress and the Supreme Court to go along with his radical proposals, he would seriously undermine America's freedom and prosperity. He would effectively reverse the victory in the Cold War, giving America to the Soviets. The Cold War was not about military conquest. It was a clash of worldviews. Now, you compare that to what Herbert Armstrong was saying in 1956 and in 1964... decades ago, more than a half century, 64 years ago, in the case of that 1956 quote, or maybe that'd be 74 years. Anyway, it was a long time ago. Mr. Armstrong said, it's a kind of warfare we don't understand or know how to cope with. It uses every diabolical means to weaken us from within. That's what's happening. To weaken us from within, sapping our strength, perverting our morals, sabotaging our educational system. Has that happened? Has America's educational system been sabotaged? Read about it in the latest Trumpet. Read about what they're teaching your children. Wrecking our social structure, destroying our spiritual and religious life, weakening our industrial and economic power, demoralizing our armed forces, and finally, after such infiltration, overthrowing our government by force and violence. Well, that's what one Bernie Sanders supporter said would happen if he doesn't win. Or if he's cheated. If he's cheated out of the nomination again, they're going to take to the streets. What was it? Milwaukee's going to burn, I think he said. PJ Media says, in one sense, the Soviets were very clearly lost the Cold War. Freedom broke the Soviet Union, even though its markets and government leave much freedom to be desired. Meanwhile, communism made inroads in the USA. If Bernie prevails, that old Soviet slogan shouted on stage at the Oscars may come to define the American government, giving the Soviets the victory they always wanted. Workers, workers of the world, unite. That's Karl Marx. That's Marxism. That's Bernie Sanders style socialism. Now, my father says in that March Trumpet, he says, just listen to the Democrats today. There's a lot of revolutionary talk. That party has been infiltrated and taken over by many of the ideas that the communists promoted decades ago. Ideas that are transforming the nation. It has become a political party far more destructive to America than the Communist Party. They are the enemy of the state. They truly are. President Trump has called them that. Devin Nunes said, why even talk to them, the ones in the media? They're enemies. They're on the other side. They're rooting for America's demise. They're rooting for the system to be brought down. They're rooting for the government to be overthrown. They want the communist ideology to spread. And when you look at root causes for the attack, the nonstop attacks, I should say, on this administration, when you look at root causes, this is it. They see Donald Trump as a clear and present danger, as a threat to their movement. It wasn't supposed to go down this way. It was supposed to be Barack Obama, and that was to be followed by 8 more years of Obama Part 2 with Hillary Clinton. And Donald Trump, of course, disrupted that plan. In that article, America has been fundamentally transformed. My father talks about the coup attempt against President Trump. He talks about some of the Obama officials like John Brennan, who voted for the Communist Party back in 1976, I think it was. And then he ends up in the CIA just a few years later. And then during the Obama years, he's made CIA director. And then during that time, he's spying on senators. He's spying on reporters. He's lying about it. And then there toward the end, he was the one that was primarily responsible for pushing the dirty dossier, Russian disinformation. Like I said earlier, you can't make this up. Here they're accusing Donald Trump of being a Russian agent, and that's exactly what they are. Judicial Watch came out with a piece yesterday. I guess they got a court to release emails from Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, during that critical period when Jeff Sessions recused himself and Bob Mueller got appointed as special counsel. And Judicial Watch went to court, the Freedom of Information Act, to get some of his communications released. And wouldn't you know, he's had all these communications with former Obama officials. And this is during the Trump presidency. This is in the summer of 2017. And he's chatting back and forth with Obama people. What a surprise. And people want to say, what are you talking about? Deep state. That's a conspiracy theory. Well, look at some of his communications. He was made deputy attorney general, or nominated, I guess, in February of 2017. So President Trump gave him the position. He's confirmed at the end of April 26th, 2017. And then on May 9th, he writes the letter. Rosenstein writes the letter to President Trump, and he recommends that Jim Comey should be fired for the way that he handled the Clinton investigation. And so President Trump fired him same day, May 9th. Now, Comey came out later and said, you know, my goal was to get a special counsel appointed. So it was all carefully coordinated. These deep state operatives, Comey frames his firing as if it's some kind of obstruction of justice, and then he's out, and then the plot begins, the leak to his friend, and then through to the New York Times, and then from all these Obama people, the pressure that's, and the encouragement that's being put upon Rosenstein from Obama people to get this special counsel appointed. May 9th, he's fired, Jim Comey. May 11th, the New York Times publishes the article based on Comey's second memo, the one where President Trump was asking for him to be loyal. And then Rosenstein, this is all according to Judicial Watch yesterday, on May 12th, this is just a couple days later, after Comey's fired, Rosenstein receives this email from former Obama special counsel Jonathan Suh. And he says, "Hi, Rod. I know there's a lot going on right now, but I wanted to send you a note of support. If there's anything I can do to be of help, please let me know. Hope you hang in there. I hope you hang in there, Rod," says this former Obama special counsel. "I know this is a difficult time. What is going on here? It's obvious what was going on. Why were there no whistleblowers? There's phone calls even in this. Why are there no transcripts?" The next day, May 13th, he receives another email Mr. Rosenstein, from former Obama White House Deputy Associate Counsel Mike Liotta. And the subject line says, thinking of you and your family. It says, I hope you're hanging in there, despite all the press attention, attacks, and contradictory claims. Poor Rod Rosenstein was coming under attack, I guess. And he needed encouragement from another Obama official. May 15th, 2017, public affairs specialist Marsha Murphy sends Rosenstein an email with the subject line, Eric Holder just called for you. The message says, please call him. Please call Eric Holder. Now, why aren't there whistleblowers coming forward about that conversation? Why is the former attorney general for Barack Obama, Barack Obama's wingman, he's self-declared as a wingman of Obama. Why is he calling the deputy attorney general, the one who is responsible for appointing Bob Mueller? Just a couple days later, what did they talk about on the phone? And why aren't there transcripts? Will there be transcripts? No, there won't be. Those transcripts will never see the light of day. U.S. Attorney John Huber, the day after he got the message to call Eric Holder, John Huber, he wrote to Rosenstein, Rod, we're proud of you. We're proud of you. Who is John Huber? He served as a United States Attorney for the District of Utah, nominated by President Obama in February 2015. And then President Trump comes in. Huber offers his resignation in March of 2017. And then just a couple months later, he's emailing Rod Rosenstein saying, Rod, hey, Rod, we're proud of you. We're really proud of you. Rosenstein received, same day, May 16th, he receives a supportive email from Obama Deputy Attorney General James Cole. Cole said this, you have the right approach. I always found that if you concentrated on doing your job, protecting the Constitution, your reputation takes care of itself. This is amazing. This is like an avalanche of support, encouragement, prodding. And it's all coming from Obama people. The New York Times runs an article on that same day, May 16th. Did Mr. Trump obstruct justice? Well, that's what Comey was out there. That's the narrative he was trying to establish. They already knew deep in the DOJ and the FBI that there was nothing to the so-called Russia collusion. There was nothing to it. And all the investigations and reports that we've had since have proven this. But they thought, well, we can get him on obstruction or something. Or it's like Weissman said the other day, if we could just get him to testify, if we can just catch him in a lie, then he can go down. Well, the Times runs that article, did Mr. Trump obstruct justice? And then the very next day, May 17th, you see the date there, May 16th on the article. And then the very next day, Rod Rosenstein appoints Special Counsel Bob Mueller. And that investigation went on for how long? 32 months, I think it was, or tens of millions of dollars. All of those thousands of interviews and subpoenas and piles of evidence. And none of it could prove their case. On the same day he appointed the special counsel, Rosenstein requests a phone call with Obama's former principal deputy solicitor general, Neil Katyal. He wants to talk to another prominent Obama official, and on it goes. Here again, you look at my father's recent article, The Latest Trumpet, America has been fundamentally transformed. You see in all of these communications, and we don't need to read all the transcripts, do we? You know what was going on. There's plenty of evidence. direct and circumstantial, to suggest that this was a nefarious plot from the beginning. And it continues, even to this day. And every time they're exposed, they just regroup, and they come forward with another preposterous claim. If you want to know what President Trump and his administration is going up against, just look at the Democrat frontrunner during this primary season. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
At National Review, just this week, Victor Davis Hanson penned a tribute to the talk radio host Rush Limbaugh. I think he's been on the air for 31 or 32 years, something like that. I think since 1988. And what a story, even if you leave aside some of the points that I can hopefully make here as we go. But just looking at it as an American success story, it's a pretty phenomenal study or read when you think about this Midwestern college dropout who just kind of bounced around from one job to the next until he found his place. He found his love, and he went after it with a passion. And what an impact he had on the world of talk radio. Hanson says, genius is often defined in myriad ways. One trusted criterion is the ability to do something extraordinary in a field where others could not, and doing something that perhaps will never be done again by anyone else. It says, by that measure, Rush Limbaugh certainly is the genius of talk radio, a genre in which he not merely excelled, but that he also single-handedly reinvented as something entirely different and entirely more powerful and instrumental in American life from what was imaginable pre-Limbaugh. Before Rush came on the scene, the AM radio, it was dying. It was dying. There was nothing really worth listening to on the AM side of the dial. But then along comes the man named Rush Limbaugh in 1988, 2 years after Mr. Armstrong died. And everything changed. It says, even stranger still, this is Hanson, his ascendance coincided with the presumed nadir of radio itself, or nadir of radio itself. It was supposedly a has-been, one-dimensional medium, long overshadowed by television. Even in the late 1980s, radio was about to be sentenced as obsolete, in the ascendant cyber age of what would become internet blogs, podcast streaming, and smartphone television. So it was about to be made obsolete. But Rush changed that. And then it explains how that to keep an audience over the course of three decades, and to do it by not compromising with his values, he really, for two generations, Hansen says, he even added to his audience. He was picking up millions of new listeners each year. And they were being educated in more traditional American values, conservative, commonsensical, as Hansen says, and skeptical toward many of the politicians in Washington. He talks about how that many thought Limbaugh's worst moment, going back to the start of Obama's presidency. And again, this ties in with some of what my father wrote in the recent Trumpet. But following that victory in November of 2008 and Barack Obama's vow to fundamentally transform the United States, it was Rush Limbaugh who said, "I hope he fails." And then the outcry from Chris Matthews and everyone else. What are you talking about? You're hoping a president fails? Don't you love America? You must hate America. You want a U.S. president to fail? And Limbaugh responded by saying, look, he wants to fundamentally transform America, and I don't want to see him do that. I don't want my nation to be fundamentally transformed. He stuck to his guns, even amid all the outrage. And you look back on the history now, what happened during those 8 years of President Obama, and then what's been happening these last 3 years. In a lot of ways, he was a lone voice. There were a few others, I suppose, when you look at those warning about this left-wing progressive Democrat socialist ideology. It says here, once elected, Obama was unbound. He lectured the nation about the wages of the West's sin, the Crusades, America's prior role in the world, and its own domestic woes. He instructed Americans on when it was time to profit and when it was not, the point at which people should concede that they had made enough money, and he listed the various reasons that he could not, as some anti-constitutional king, grant unconstitutional amnesties by fiat before he went on to do just that. And these were the Obama years. Hansen says his forte was explaining why nominal conservatives, this is Rush's forte. Now he's switching to talk about Rush. His forte was explaining why nominal conservatives were infected by a fatal virus of wanting to be liked by the mainstream media and the cultural elite, and thus often grew in office, moving leftward, as if they had become smarter and more sophisticated than those who had voted for them. He was the only one that was exposing them, going back to the late 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. All of these Republicans that would get voted in, and so many of them would swing to the left when they were in Washington because they wanted to go to all the cocktail parties. And they wanted the Washington Post to write nice things about them. And they wanted Chris Matthews to praise them. And Rush Limbaugh exposed that and called for people to stick to their conservative principles. He said, why not do it like Reagan? Stand up for what's right. Hold to those principles. Stop caving into the pressure. Well, along the way, he really exposed the media for what it was, for what it is today even. It's far worse. It says here, the New York Times story picked up by the local paper, the NPR segment they heard in the car, and the commentary of the ABC, CBS, or NBC evening news anchors were rarely, if at all, the whole truth and anything but the truth. Limbaugh reminded them that what was purportedly the news was increasingly the output of a rather narrow slice of cocooned America between Washington, D.C., and New York City. Just the tiny little corridor between D.C. and New York. Offered up by affluent progressives who had come to believe that the media's role was not to report events, per se, but to do so in a way that would not only educate an otherwise blinkered American masses, educate the otherwise blinkered American masses, but would also improve them morally and make them redeemable spiritually. In other words, the goal here is not to report the news events per se. It's to help our audience to become more progressive, to help our audience to lean more to the left. And Rush called them out. Called them the drive-bys. He's been doing that for years. He was the one that started in with the fake news charge. Donald Trump picked up on that. It makes you wonder how much Donald Trump listened to Rush over the years. It's interesting when you look at 2016, these two media giants, I'm speaking of Rush Limbaugh, but also Sean Hannity, they, I think more than other commentators, they knew Donald Trump personally. They golfed with him. I think Hannity talks about how that he's known him for 20 years, 30 years. And I think the rest of us, they looked at what was on the surface. You know, the history as a playboy, all the divorces, the fact that he was in New York, the fact that he was contributing to Hillary Clinton's campaign. And of course now, President Trump says, that's just the way the system worked. I had to do those things to get my hotels built. But these two individuals that were so enthusiastically supportive of him while he was campaigning, I think they knew a little more about what he actually believed. They knew a little bit more about his ideology, what he championed. And of course, to this day, Mr. Limbaugh has been a staunch supporter of Donald Trump. But with so much of the media, you see the corruption now. I played that clip for you last week, Devin Nunes, who said one of the most important things that President Trump has done is he's exposed the media. He has exposed the drive-bys for what they are. They are not honest journalists. They have an agenda, all of them. Donald Trump comes along in 2015 and 16 and he calls them out. You're liars. It's fake news. Hansen says Rush was hated by the left, supposedly for his politically incorrect isms and ologies. In truth, it was because he so often made them look ridiculous. He exposed the left. He exposed the media. He made them look ridiculous. He told you where these policies were leading. He was very prescient that way. And I think prepared along the way for where we are at this moment, for where we were in 2015 and 16. When you consider the monopoly that the left had on all things, media, entertainment, culture, sports, politics, universities, education. Rush carved out a little slice for himself on talk radio, and quite a few others followed. One final quote here from Victor Davis Hanson. It says, "So what was inconceivable in 1988 was not just that any one person could leap from local prominence to national dominance, but that he could empower rather than replace." So he didn't come along and just wipe out everyone else on talk radio and they left. He empowered others, Hansen says. His legions of radio subordinates. How many radio hosts have followed in his steps? It says, far from making them irrelevant, Limbaugh energized talk radio hosts. It says once he became a national force, hundreds of others became far more effective conservative local and regional voices, partly through the art of emulation, partly through scheduling to lead in to or follow Limbaugh's daily three-hour show, partly in general in the general renewed public interest in talk radio itself. So he gave rise to all of these other hosts and commentators, and so many of them conservative. The liberals tried to start their talk radio station, Air America, I think it was. All these millions of dollars funneled into it, and it was just a big flop. A total flop. They couldn't quite emulate Rush's success. And so a lot of the reason why they hate him so much, besides that he makes them look ridiculous, there's a lot of jealousy that motivates it as well. Well, as I said at the start, when you talk about the groundwork being laid for where we are today, when I think of KPCG and even this program, I don't think so much of Rush Limbaugh, as inspiring as that story is. I just went through it, after all. But you think more about Herbert Armstrong and the small start that he got on radio back in September of 1933, that small 100-watt radio station in Eugene, Oregon. He just had a 15-minute radio show, a weekly broadcast, and the slot was opened up to him. I've told this story before. It's in the autobiography, but it was opened up for him because nobody else wanted it. No other preachers were willing to get up early enough on Sunday to preach, to give a live presentation. He did it, and the work grew and grew and grew. There was at one point in the 1930s, his routine was to conduct a church service Saturday morning in Eugene, Oregon, and then head over to Jefferson, Oregon for an afternoon service. And then he drove to Seattle that night, Saturday night, arrived around midnight. Then he was on the air in Seattle first thing the next morning, and then on the road again in order to make it to Portland for a Sunday afternoon broadcast. And then, in this particular instance, he hurriedly hit the road for three more hours or so that he could host an evangelistic campaign in Eugene Sunday night. You can read about some of this history in the autobiography, but if you think about blazing the trail and then looking at, too, just how the technology has made it so much easier for us to reach through to you. If I'm giving a broadcast, a live broadcast, just over the air of a 100-watt radio station, it's just reaching a little tiny corner of northwestern Oregon, I guess. Whereas, as small as this audience is, it is diverse, and it does come from many, many nations, and the audience size is growing as well. But I still shake my head at what we've been able to do on three different continents, in hotel rooms, in this beautiful studio, or when we're back at Edmond. And the message goes out, and it is having an impact. And there are people who are tuning in daily because they know how much fake reporting goes on everywhere else. They know that we're living in a time when the transgressors are come to a full. They know we're living at a time when the truth is being cast to the ground. And so they're tuning in. They're listening. They're seeking after God's truth. And God, of course, is seeking after them. Jesus said in John 4 and verse 34, "My meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work." Verse 35 says, say not you, there are 4 months and then comes the harvest. Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they're white, all ready to harvest. We have to harvest people along. We have to bring them along. That's why we have these PACs in Birmingham and coming up in Belfast in a week and a half. Verse 36 says, "And he that reaps wages, he that reaps receives wages and gathers fruit unto eternal life, that both he that sows and he that reaps may rejoice together. And herein is that saying true, one sows and another reaps. I send you to reap that whereon you bestowed no labor, other men labored, and you are entered in into their labors." We've come along, so many of us, long after the groundwork has been laid or done, long after the trail has been blazed. But how exciting it is that even if we are here a little late in the game, 2020, that we can actually have an exciting role to play in harvesting souls for God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.